your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and CommunityProgressiveRadio.org, as usual. We have two great guests on the soapbox today. Our first guest is Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn, and Brendan is part or was part of the Port Militarization Resistance in Olympia, Washington. And Brendan and other plaintiffs are suing the military and U.S. government for essentially infiltrating their organization, inhibiting their First and Fourth Amendment rights. So we're going to talk to Brendan and find out more information about that and about the lawsuit. Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your last name is very intriguing and quite a mouthful for so early in the morning.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes it is for me, too.
So, Brendan, tell my listeners about you and what you all were doing up north.
Well, I'm based in New York, but for the last several years I was living in Olympia, Washington. And the story really starts in about May 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the state of Washington has about 70 different public ports, and it's a very highly militarized area within the U.S. There's several military bases there. When I was living there, it was Fort Lewis Army Base, McChord Air Force Base. It's now called Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Bangor Naval Base and Bremerton Naval Base and some other facilities out there. So it's very much a military area, very much a military town. And what was going on is the military out of Joint Base Lewis-McChord was sending Army shipments, mostly Stryker vehicles, which is, to give you a visualization, it kind of looks a little like a tank, but it doesn't have the slats on the side. It just has wheels, so it's kind of a crossover between a tank and a an SUV or a Humvee or something. And so they're shipping all these through the ports, mostly the Port of Olympia and Port of Tacoma, people decided to respond. So in May of 2006, a group formed called Port Militarization Resistance, or PMR for short, and we basically decided to step outside of the spectacle of protests where it's just marching and holding signs and actually take civil disobedience and direct action and try to either slow down, if not actually stop these military shipments over, en route to Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's how it all started. And we're, it only started as a few people and very rapidly grew to hundreds and hundreds of people who were involved. Anytime there's a shipment through any of the ports in Washington State, people would go down day and night and try and block the shipments. In addition to that, there was a lot of work we were doing with the military community, with active duty soldiers who were getting shipped off to Iraq and Afghanistan. And a number of veterans from those wars, they came back and were disgusted with what they're forced to do and what they had witnessed and decided to join us. And we were actually also working directly with soldiers that were resisting and refusing to go overseas and to fight in these wars. So I think that was a very important thing that we were doing. And because of what we were doing was so successful, and actually in November 2007, we actually shut down the Port of Olympia. I think once was for 18 hours total, the next was for 12 hours, so they weren't shipping any military shipment.
Mm-hmm.
So the military has not been back to the Port of Olympia since then, and they're now either flying the Stryker vehicles to Texas and shipping them out of ports there, or just flying them directly to Western and Central Asia. So it was a pretty big success as far as the anti-war movement is concerned. It was one of the more militant things that was going on, but this definitely caught the attention of the Army, to such a degree that we found out through public records requests in 2009 that, you know, and we were always suspicious that there's some kind of law enforcement surveillance or something going on, but we had no idea. We found out through these public records requests that the Army had actually sent an intelligence officer that I knew and thought of as a personal friend and fellow activist who went by the name John Jacob. His real name was John J. Towery II, and he was an Army intelligence person working for what's called the Fusion Center at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. So the Army and also the Navy, the Air Force, and the Coast Guard, and a whole bunch of other local law enforcement and also federal agencies were involved with this surveillance apparatus that was spying on us, that had infiltrated our organizations, infiltrated the movement, and relayed this information to, pretty much the federal branches of the government and to the military.
Well, Brandon, so this brings us up to today, and you have filed a lawsuit, and tell us, my listeners, about the lawsuit and where that stands, etc.
Yes, it's a federal case, and it is called Panagakis v. Towery. Towery, of course, being the name of the spy, Panagakis being the name of a co-plaintiff in the suit, who is a port militarization resistance or PMR activist, who was one of the people that was spied on. There's some updates with the case, but we filed the suit a couple years ago against every branch of the government, every branch of the military, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard, and have since added the city of Tacoma, city of Olympia to the suit. We just had another amended complaint to the suit, and the New York Times reported on this in Common Dreams and also some regional media in the Northwest just last week. But we added another name of defendants to the lawsuit of people we're suing and found some new information. We added someone named Chris Adamson, who is working for Pierce County Sheriff's, that's where Tacoma is located, who was working for the Rig 5, which is part of the what was called the Washington Joint Analytical Center, what's now commonly known as a fusion center. And this is so important as far as civil liberties and civil rights cases are concerned right now. There's some lawyers that are saying that this is probably the most important case going on currently in the U.S. Because, among other things, it is, one, it's going after the military for suing. We're suing the military for, and this, it's a little complicated. This isn't really part of our suit, but they pretty much broke Posse Comitatus, which was a federal act passed in the 1870s after the Civil War, when a number of Southerners were, you know, incensed that the federal military was being used for local law enforcement purposes. So it broke that. The Army is in clear violation of that. But what's really important with this most recent update with the suit is that we're adding Chris Adamson, from who's involved with this fusion center. And for your listeners who don't really know what a fusion center is, they were started under the Bush administration back in about 2003. They were expanded under the Obama administration. There's dozens of them that exist all over the U.S., and they're basically an information sharing and intelligence gathering unit, which connects the intelligence gathering functions of federal agencies such as the CIA, FBI, the U.S. military, and local law enforcement. So they're all sharing these various information. It's a counterterrorism development. So these fusion centers pretty much look at what they refer to as threats to the U.S. government. So unfortunately, that they take everything on one extreme, from Al-Qaeda to everything on the other extreme, if you could even call it that, such as Grannies for Peace, or you know, Women in Black and different anti-war groups, peace groups, and lumps them all together and sees them as threats to the U.S. And so we are caught up in this whole spying that the Fusion Center is involved in. And this is also really important for people. I mean, really, it's important to anyone that's concerned about civil liberties and civil rights, but also the Occupy movement. It was revealed last year that there's a Occupy group in Texas that was infiltrated and spied on by a police officer connected with a Texas Fusion Center. And there's been revelations that have come up this last year of Fusion Centers and spying on the Occupy movement. So it's a very frightening thing. It's a very new and very scary development of really what we're witnessing is, you know, the creation of a mass surveillance state under the Bush and Obama administrations.
Well, absolutely. What if anything, did the recent Snowden revelations reveal to you and your you know, co-defendants, or you know, you're one of the plaintiffs, right?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, and so did those revelations shed any light on your specific case or actions?
I think they did, definitely. I mean, around the same time that you know, this NSA surveillance program was revealed by, you know, the courageous acts of Snowden. Mm-hmm. We also found some information very particular and unique to our case. And what's so scary about this, you know, these NSA revelations, they're not just collecting data and mining for information and practicing surveillance on just about everyone in the U.S. They're also spying on governments overseas and you know,
yeah,
governments that are ostensibly allies of the U.S. government. So, you know, it brings up this idea that the U.S. government just really does not trust anyone or anything, including its closest allies. And to me, it just sounds a lot like what eventually developed in East Germany with their surveillance state, I mean, with the Stasi, and it was a mass surveillance state where they kept tabs on everyone. The revelation that came up in our case around the time that the NSA information was leaked to the media, we actually found out that there were four activists that were, back in 2007, put on a domestic terrorist watch list.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of them. Jeff Berryhill, who's another co-plaintiff in the suit, is another. There are two others for the sake of anonymity. I won't mention their names, but one of them was pretty much put on this domestic terrorist list back in 2007 for the crime, if you could call it that, of having anarchist literature in his backpack. That's the only reason he was put on the list, and the police confiscated it, still have that as evidence to this day. He wasn't convicted of any crime or anything. Jeff Berryhill and I were, and you know, the information is out there online. There's an article that Common Dreams did, people are interested, but it has these sheets with information on both Jeff Berryhill and myself, which has our pictures, a lot of the information is redacted, but FBI numbers, Social Security numbers, our addresses, our so-called associates, other activists, and activist organizations we're in, such as Students for Democratic Society. What's very disconcerting about these, you know, both Jeff and myself ending up on this terrorist watch list is, well, first of all, I mean, we know what this government does to terrorists, you know, both real and suspected terrorists.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they're U.S. citizen or not, such as the case of Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son who were assassinated by drones by the U.S. military in Yemen. Is that we were put on this list by local law enforcement who had convened in a regional conference in Spokane, Washington, back in 2007, where law enforcement officers from around Washington State and California, at least is the information we have so far, convened, and they were all encouraged to participate by filling out these dossiers, these sheets, and profiling people that they wanted to put on this domestic terrorist list. So it isn't any kind of analyst, you know, with the FBI or anything like that. This is local law enforcement doing this. And we have information that shows that they're doing this in Washington and California. I'm curious what local law enforcement are doing all over the rest of the country. And there's another news story that it was in the news recently where a former civil rights activist and Black Panther, Assata Shakur, who's been, essentially living in exile in Cuba for the
right.
last couple decades. She was the first woman that was put on the FBI's top 10 most wanted terrorist watch list for the crime, which, it's come up in court that it's very unlikely that she actually did this, and she was really caught up in COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, which tried to dismantle and destroy the civil rights movement and the new left in the 60s and 70s, for allegedly killing the shooting of a New Jersey police officer. So, just put that in context, someone is put on a terrorist watch list because, and a most wanted list at that, because, they allegedly killed a police officer. And, my case is clearly different, but Jeff Berryhill and I were at least from the information we gathered, put on this domestic terrorist list because of our perceived views of the police, and had a number of had some information on there which clearly wasn't true, and that's why we were put on there.
Well, yeah, you have to be, very rightfully, shall I say, nervous about that, because especially Assata Shakur, she could be hit with a Hellfire missile, and everybody around her could be obliterated because of this out-of-control government we have. So, you are rightfully, should be rightfully concerned about being on that list. And I just want to talk about something in your press release, is that the Obama administration tried to dismiss the Panagakos lawsuit, but a Ninth Circuit federal court decision said that you do have, your claims of First and Fourth Amendment violations are plausible. It just seems like, the First and Fourth Amendment especially are absolutely being trashed by the USA Patriot Act and the actions of our government. So can you talk a little bit about that? The Obama administration trying to, they must have filed a petition to dismiss the case.
As far as we're trying to get more knowledge, with discovery and more records requests about to what extent that the Bush and Obama administrations, as far as the inner circles, the cabinet, and the actual presidents themselves are concerned, how much knowledge did they have of this surveillance program? Because that's the important thing. It's a surveillance program, and there's just story after story after story of the, the NSA revelations and the grand jury investigations of anti-war and peace activists, of Palestinian activists, of anarchists in the Northwest. All these things that are coming up, the surveillance and infiltration of the Occupy movement, very, very frightening things. But, as far as the actions of the Obama administration in particular, it was coming from the Department of, the U.S. Attorney's office, and also the lawyers that are representing the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and also Olympia and Tacoma. So they're the ones that were trying to throw this case out. It was appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington State, and this was, I believe, in December, or January rather, that this happened. There's a New York Times article written by Colin Moynihan on it. But what's so significant about that is, for the first time, in at least my lawyer's knowledge, Larry Hilda's, this was the first time that a judge actually said, yes, you can actually go forward and continue with the suit against the U.S. military. Yes, they were violating your First Amendment rights and other rights. So it's a pretty significant decision. It's, you know, I guess more generally, as far as the Obama administration is concerned, you know, I didn't vote for him, but I think that, you know, a lot of people did vote for him thinking that he was the peace candidate, and we've seen, I mean, from the first week in office, that he was not the peace candidate. And as far as, you know, just domestic civil rights and civil liberties are concerned, I would argue that he has not only continued the policies of his predecessor, George W. Bush, but he has in many cases been more to the right than people like George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, and even Richard Nixon, as far as civil liberties are concerned.
Oh, absolutely. And Brendan, we just have a couple minutes left. If you send me, you know, you mentioned, I know you, I have some of those links that you mentioned, but if you send me the links to the articles, New York Times, Common Dreams, I can get them up on my website when I send out the notice about this interview so people can get more information. That would be great. But do you have a specific website where people can get more information?
Well, there's one that we have to update. It kind of acts as a clearinghouse of information on John Towery, the Army spy. It's just johntowery.com. That's T-O-W-E-R-Y. So there's a lot of information there. Democracy Now! Has also done a lot of coverage on this case, and was really, you know, the leading media outlet that broke the story, you know, as well as the New York Times and the Olympian newspaper. So yeah, I would check out johntowery.com. And I would also say, I wanted to mention this earlier, but just as a nod, you know, of solidarity, I guess, a gesture of solidarity to the work that, the anti-work that you have done, some of the work that we are doing in Washington State was inspired very directly from Camp Casey. We had actually set up something called Camp Suzanne back in 2006 in support of Suzanne Swift, who is in the Army, went AWOL because she was essentially raped by her commanding officer. So, you know, I think that was, you know, taking actions like that and actually taking very direct action to bring the war home, and not in a literal sense, but letting people know what war actually looks like and that we can actually stop it. I think things like that is what made us such a threat to the military.
Well, absolutely, and I'm always inspired by the words of Mario Savio that says we have to throw our bodies on the gears and on all the apparatus. And I watched your actions up there with great interest, and it was a huge victory for us. And I know the lawsuits and all of this legal hassle, you know, I've gone through so much of this, you know, they just do this to harass us and think it's going to make us stop. I know that's hard, but it's just super important that we fight them whenever we can. I just got arrested at the CIA, and I'm going to have to fly back to, you know, Virginia to go on trial. But we have to put these issues, you know, because we might not be victorious in court, but we have a chance to put it in the court of public opinion. And I thank you all so much for what you did and for what you continue to do.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And yeah, I mean, you really have a great point. The battle is not just in the courts, and we're doing this really to get more information about this surveillance program, to see what it actually looks like, and to share that information with the public, but it's in the streets. And, you know, our actions in the Port of Olympia in 2007, it's a testament to that.
Well, absolutely. Well, Brandon Maslowski-Dunn, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and keep us updated about the developments, all right?
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, great, Brandon. Have a great day.
All right, take care.
Our next guest on the Soapbox is Ethan McCord. And if you remember, Ethan was the soldier who rescued two children in the collateral murder video that became so prominent and was exposed by WikiLeaks. And we're going to catch up with Ethan and hear about some wonderful good news he recently had.
Ethan McCord, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you back on. And you know, when we were chatting before we started, I just told you how great you sound, and you do sound really, really good.
Thank you. I feel good. I feel a lot better than I had been previously.
You have a reason to feel a little bit upbeat, and we'll talk about that soon. But first, remind my listeners, you were on the show before, and you were talking about the collateral murder video when it first came out. So remind my listeners about your participation in that.
Sure. I was a member of 2nd Battalion, 16th Infantry Rangers out of Fort Riley, Kansas. We were sent to Iraq, mainly Baghdad, parts of New Baghdad, Kamalaya, Fedaleya, Riassa area, and we were part of Bush's surge. Within a couple of months of being there in Iraq, the video that was shot on that day, which I had no idea I was being videoed that day, showed the Apaches opening fire on a group of mostly unarmed men, and then shooting a van with a Good Samaritan in it with his children. But that day we were there to basically do knock-in searches is what we were mainly doing. We'd cordon off the area and go through the neighborhood and knock on the doors and ask to search their homes. I say ask, but it was more like telling them.
Right.
So then I'm on the ground and I heard the Apaches open fire. And again and again, and we were told to move that location immediately. And we just started running towards the sound of the fire. When I got up onto the scene, saw that group of men on the corner who had been completely decimated by these 30-millimeter rounds. And then I heard a child crying.
And who were those men? First, before we go on to the kids, who were those men?
The men on the corner were civilians. The journalists were there was one journalist who was face down in a pile of trash. He'd been killed, and he had a camera with him. There was another driver who you could see in the video he survived the first round of gunfire. Only to be shot and killed again when they open up fire, when the Good Samaritan pulls up.
Okay.
So this was, you know, there was an AK-47 there, and there was also an RPG. But in doing my own investigating and speaking with people in Iraq, you can see in the beginning of the video that there's a mosque directly around the corner from where this incident took place, and they were actually mosque guards. You know, coming from experience in Iraq, it is not unusual to see someone walking around with an AK-47, having a rifle on a battle in Iraq is not automatic. Like, oh, we need to kill him.
Right.
So in the video, these guys, the pilots were over exaggerating every single thing that they were saying. And they used the term black bongo truck because that's what earlier in the day we had problems with, when this was clearly a blue minivan.
Mm-hmm.
So you're telling me that some Apache pilots are unfamiliar with a minivan versus a bongo truck?
Right.
And I've always thought if you're colorblind, you couldn't be a pilot, so.
Oh, that's true, huh?
I heard crying when I got there and could tell that it was coming from the van.
Mm-hmm.
And being a father myself, I could tell that it was the cries of a little girl who, it didn't sound like pain. It was just like if you've ever heard your child wake up from a horrible nightmare.
Right. She was frightened.
Just like someone hold me, someone help me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got around to the passenger side of the door, I looked in and I saw a little girl who was about 4 years old. She was covered in blood and glass. She had glass in her eyes. And her face was so bloody that I remember her, when she looked at me, her eyes were so, like, ghostly white. It was like she was looking through me.
Mm-hmm.
Not directly at me. It was haunting.
Mm-hmm.
And her arms were outstretched to me to, like, please hold her. And next to her, half on the floorboard with his head resting on the bench seat was a boy who was roughly about 7 or 8 years old. And I thought he was dead because he had a severe wound to his head. And then in the driver's seat was the father who had laid over his children basically to save their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled the little girl out of the van and yelled for a medic, and we went to the house behind the van, and I was picking glass out of her eyes and running water through her hair, trying to get all the blood and glass off of her. Then handed the medic the little girl and went back outside to the van. And when I looked inside and started to take pictures, because, you know, we always had to have that warp horn for our upper officers.
Right.
I wanted pictures of everything. So when I was looking through the viewfinder of the camera, it looked like the boy took like a labored breath.
Mm-hmm.
And I dropped the camera and started screaming out that the boy was still alive, and nobody was coming towards me. Nobody cared. So I scooped the boy up and I ran him to the Bradley that was already getting ready to leave, and I was hoping that it wasn't too late. So I'm running with the boy, and I'm telling him, you know, I got you. It's okay. Don't die. And the boy looked up at me, and then his eyes rolled back into his head. And you can see in the video, I stopped running.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I thought that the boy had died in my arms at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I laid him in the Bradley, and then I got berated by my lieutenant, who told me to quit worrying about these MFing kids and go for security.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so then I needed to see mental health because I was having a hard time with it. And I got berated by some of the other soldiers and called a bunch of names because I needed to go see mental health. And you know, everyone said, a lot of people say, well, if you weren't ready to kill, you shouldn't have joined the military. And the thing is that if I joined the military to protect my country,
right,
and I joined the military to kill the enemy, not to kill women and children.
Exactly.
And innocent people. So that's going to affect me.
And who is the enemy? You know, the enemy is who our lying government tells you is the enemy.
Right. Well, according to the government, we're the enemy. I mean, they're charging Bradley Manning with aiding the enemy for releasing information to us. So I guess we're the enemy now. So,
expect
those tanks anytime.
I agree with that. So, Ethan, I know that you, as well as many veterans, struggle after you get home, and I know that you have struggled, and I know you're struggling, but you saving the kids and the struggle that you've had just makes me love you, because you care. You care. You have a heart. And the people, it seems to me, that don't care, that don't care, have less of a struggle. So it might be really, really hard for you, and I know it is, but I'm just really proud of you for feeling this way. And I think that you're going to be okay, because you have a lot of people that do love you. And but you had something exciting happen recently that I wanted you to come on and tell my listeners and me about.
Yeah. Well, I had a German television crew for Stern TV here, and they've been filming me for a few days. It's a story, me and my family. And the last day, they asked that me and my family come into the living room and sit down all together. And we did, and they had the cameras rolling and everything, and they said, we have something for you. Somebody gave this to us and wanted you to see it. And I had no idea what I was going to be looking at. And as soon as it came on, and I saw the little boy and the little girl, I instantly started crying. My wife was crying. All my children were crying. The little girl was speaking, and she said, she called me. I remember Ethan McCord. I know him by face. And she said, I wanted to thank him for saving me and my brother. I'm doing good in school. And I want to be a doctor when I grow up.
Aww.
So that I can help injured people also. And she says, you'll always be in my memories. And for me, that was, probably the best gift anybody could have given my family. Because we struggle so much with this. My family has to deal with my PTSD, my depression that comes and goes. Just you never know when it's going to happen. And people talk about what soldiers have to go through, but families are the real heroes. They have to go through so much. Sitting there with my family, we were all crying and hugging. It was a really great moment for us, and especially my teenage daughters, who I don't really talk to about all of this. And they get it, though. They understand, and I think it brought our family closer. But just knowing that the kids are okay, they're doing good, they don't hate me. Like I envisioned that they would hate me, that they would just hate my guests, no matter if I pulled them out I've often second-guessed myself if I really gave them a better life by saving them.
Right.
Because what kind of life were they going to live after that? Because the boy had wound to his head. But they are doing great, and I couldn't honestly have asked for anything better as a gift.
Oh, that is so... I'm crying right now. That's such a wonderful story, and we have so few of those wonderful stories.
Yeah, you get the opportunity for this to happen. I guess it took the German crew like quite a while to find them. But just to know that they're doing great, and they've gotten so big. I don't even know how to explain it. It's like it was like looking at my own children, because that's the way I viewed them.
Uh-huh.
When I looked inside that van, I didn't see two little Iraqi children.
Right.
I saw my own children in that van. And so when I carried them like my own children.
You gave them life, so they are your children.
Yeah, that's the way I like to look at it.
One thing that we really are not very good about as a nation, I think, is realizing that all of the children of the world are precious, and You know, they belong to all of us. And so, you know, I have a chance to talk to a lot of people from Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And how many tens of thousands of children have been killed or horribly wounded or suffering from cancers because of the depleted uranium and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
But, and, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be upset about 20 babies being killed.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
we should, but, you know, let's put things in proportion. And I'm like you, when I see those children, I see my grandchildren.
Right.
And I wish more people were like that, that realize.
Well, just hold everybody equal. I mean, if we're going to cry about 20 children, why are we not crying about the children that Obama's bombing right now?
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, you know, he comes on national TV and sheds one fake tear and wipes it away with his finger, and everybody's like, oh, he cares. No, he doesn't.
Did you see that?
If he did,
mm-hmm.
he would stop.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Did you see that it was an Irish parliamentarian, Claire Daly, calling him a hypocrite? And Obama just visited Ireland, and he went up to Northern Ireland and was talking to teenagers about the violence in Northern Ireland. And this woman, Claire Daly, I'll send you the YouTube of it, she just stood up in the Irish Parliament, it's called the Doyle, and she ripped Obama a new, you know what, for being for all his drone bombings and wars. And then she also ripped the Irish media and Irish establishment apart for kissing his butt while he was over there. It was awesome. I'll send it to you. It was like,
yeah, I've got to see that.
And so,
yeah,
the hypocrisy is really astounding to me. And until we care about all of the children in the world like you did, then our hopes for peace are really hopeless.
Yeah, and really that's all I did. I mean, that day, I didn't know I was being videoed. I knew that I was going to get a lot of shit from the guys that I was with for doing this, but I didn't care at that point anymore. I just did what any father would do, what I would hope any father would do if put in the same situation. Mm-hmm. And if the roles were reversed, I would want somebody to do that for my children.
Right.
And that's all I did.
Well, Ethan, I'm so happy that you got to get a message from them. That's just really...
Yeah, it's almost like vindication a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Because you have been through a hard time. And... you know, like you said, you got shit from your commanding officers. You got shit from your fellow soldiers.
Still getting shit from them.
And you're still getting it, I know.
But it's okay. You know, here's the way I look at it. Once you start to challenge somebody's self-justifications, you know, make them actually look at themselves in the mirror, and they're going to get angry. They're going to get violent, especially infantrymen. And they're going to do everything they can to shut you up. So that's what I'm doing to them, and they're hating it. I, in fact, you know, just got an email from a soldier today who said, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Thank you very much, an active duty soldier. So that helps.
Yeah.
But not all of them feel that I'm like some Bradley Manning traitor type of person. And, you know, but hey, you know what? If what Bradley Manning did, and if I'm a traitor, then call us traitors, because I'll do it all day long.
If you're a traitor, then I'm a traitor too, because I am, I love humanity. And so if loving humanity means that I'm in opposition to my government, then what does that say about my government?
Right. Absolutely.
Right.
Man, we're just gonna make all kinds of weird names for Vacaville. Everyone's gonna think that.
Yeah.
These people came out of Vacaville. Oh, God.
Yeah. Me, you, and Charles Manson. Did you know that Charles?
Oh, yeah. CMF. He was there at CMF for a while, wasn't he?
He was when he was first convicted. So.
Hey, you know, Papa Roach came out of Vacaville.
That's true. My kids went to school with some of them.
Yeah.
Hey,
my brother.
Like, we're the best of Vacaville, so one of these days.
Yeah, pretty much.
Vacaville will be proud of us one of these days, maybe.
Hopefully. But I don't really care what Vacaville thinks of me.
Well, but, you know, I live here, so.
Yeah, you have to deal with it. I haven't lived there in over 15 years, so, and I'm happy about that.
I don't care what anybody thinks about me, if you put it that way, because I got to do what I think is right, and I got to be able to look at myself in the mirror.
Yeah.
And
right.
I'm really proud to know you, and I'm really proud to know that there's someone else from this town that is standing up for all the kids. And so, Ethan.
Thank you. That means a lot.
Man, and I know, I, like I said, you're my adopted son, and you have me, and
yeah,
you have my sister now, so, you know, we're always here for you, and I know that you have a lot of support, and that, I think that's the most important thing, is don't focus on the detractors, but, you know, focus on the people who support and love you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All
okay. I care about is my kids supporting me, so.
Absolutely. That's all you have to care about. So, Ethan McCord, thanks so much for being on the show again, and congratulations, and like I said, keep in touch.
All right, thanks for having me on again.
That's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you were inspired to further research or further action. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer and our liaison with Community Progressive Radio, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank my guests, Ethan McCord and Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn. But as always, I'd like to especially thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.